I'm Chuck Foster, host of Reggae Central right here on KPFK. Join me Sunday afternoons from 2 to 5 for 3 hours of the best in ska, rocksteady, roots and culture, dub and dancehall, from the foundational Jamaican recordings to the latest international releases. That's Reggae Central, 2 to 5 p.m. every Sunday right here on KPFK.
This is Mumia Abu-Jamal, and you're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles and 98.7 Santa Barbara.
From Pacifica Radio in San Francisco, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, the legendary William Means, co-founder of the American Indian Movement and a leader in the struggle to free Leonard Peltier. And we'll continue our special reports from writer-activist Kate Raphael in the occupied West Bank, where violent settlers continue to collaborate with the IDF to threaten, beat, and kill Palestinians and steal their land. All this and more coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Once again, I am honored with our two guests. One of them is also a producer at this show, but we are joined by Mr. William Means. He's a co-founder of the American Indian Movement, the International Indian Treaty Council. And also joining us is our good friend, brother, senior producer here at Flashpoints and Flash Under, Miguel Gabriel Molina. This is the time of the year, Bill and Miguel, that people come together to liberate Alcatraz, to remember the struggle for indigenous rights, and to, among other things, speak up, demand the release of Leonard Peltier. But Bill, could I start with you? Could you remind us, why do we go to Alcatraz? What does it mean? Why is it significant in the context of the indigenous communities?
Well, Alcatraz is always welcome, and thanks for having some time for us to celebrate this very important historical happening there on Alcatraz. I remember back in the 60s, Alcatraz was occupied two times. And eventually, in 69, I think it was, they stayed for several days. I mean, a month or so. But anyway, my father was one of the early occupiers, but they just went for the day, and then they left. That was back in, I think, 64 or something like that. So Alcatraz represents a time in history when, you know, a lot of Indian land was being occupied throughout the Americas. And they had this law within the United States Department of Interior that whenever surplus land was declared as surplus, or land that the United States occupied was declared surplus, and it returned to the Indian tribe that was originally there. And so this is why the reason people went to Alcatraz originally was to show America that we wanted the treaties to be lived up to, because treaty rights are, you know, cornerstone of the continued existence of American Indians and the law. Treaties are the law of the land, supreme law of the land, it says in the United States Constitution. So having said that, Alcatraz has also represented the resurgence of indigenous peoples' fight for their land and rights. And of course, being in the Bay Area, all the things that happened there, Cesar Chavez, civil rights, Berkeley riots, all these things has always made Northern California kind of a hub, kind of a revolutionary community. And they've always come forward to support various movements. And it's always been a resurgence, a representative resurgence of Indian liberation movements, both nationally and internationally. And so it's with great pleasure that we come back. And, of course, we remember a young man by the name of, at the time, his name was Bill Wapapa. And he decided, as a member of Oakland AIM chapter and the AIM house there in Oakland, to reestablish the annual Thanksgiving. We used to call it the un-Thanksgiving. And we used to call it Thanks-taking. There's another word that we had for,
yes.
And so we'd all go to Alcatraz on Thanksgiving rather than have a meal, and we'd do fasting to represent the will of the indigenous people of not only the Bay Area, but across the Americas, to fight for the land, and that the land was sacred and the land is our mother. And so that's the philosophical reason that we've always occupied Alcatraz on an annual basis, to show the people of America that we are the original landlords. We are the landlords of this land. And that's the reason why we go back and reclaim it. When everybody's having a nice Thanksgiving, we wonder ourselves as Indian people, indigenous people, what do we have to be thankful for? Well, we have the earth, we have the land. What little we have left, we want to remind people that we still exist. So that's some of the main reasons of why we always go to Alcatraz on Thanksgiving.
You know, Bill, we some say they can still hear the voices of those who were held prison, among the many Native Americans. The prisons across this country have been filled with Native Americans. Of course, we know there's a big battle on now to free Leonard Peltier. But if it was 100 years ago, he could have ended up, or a little bit short, he could have ended up in Alcatraz. So it's a liberating of the spirits of those who were held there, right?
Yes. And I think that Leonard Peltier represents the, you know, the symbol of America's treatment towards the American Indian. These arbitrary and unilateral court cases they have, in which they have a mock trial and attempt to extend the rights of the court to our people, but in fact, they misuse the evidence, they corrupt the evidence, they corrupt witnesses, and get the result that they originally started for, as in the Peltier case, in which there were many, many questions. But, you know, the judges and the appeals would never deal with the issues of the law. They always say that two FBI agents were killed, therefore somebody has to be punished. That's the attitude of the judges that have ruled against him, and they never say anything about the actual evidence. So the evidence of corruption, of, you know, messing with witnesses, of the evidence being tampered with, So all these things have happened in the case of Leonard Peltier, but he remains in prison for over 40-some years now, maybe 44, 45, most of his life. And so we have a consistent, ever since he was jailed, we have had a consistent support for him worldwide. People like Amnesty International, you know, Desmond Tutu, some very famous human rights activists have come forward and supported the right for him to have a new trial, or at least give him now humanitarian parole, so that he's been in all this time, maybe one of the longest serving Indian people in the history of the prison. And he's down in Florida, you know, miles and miles away from his family, which he comes from North Dakota. At least move him closer, or show some humanitarian concern, or show some respect for his rights, and move him closer to home where his family can easily visit him and give him some hope. After all, he's been in there all this time. And so we'll continue to recognize him as the number one American Indian political prisoner in the federal system of incarceration.
We are speaking with Mr. William Means. He is a co-founder of the American Indian Movement, the International Indian Treaty Council, and has been in it, in this struggle, from longer than I can even remember. We're always honored to have you, Bill. Also joining us from our crew, your old friend, comrade, Miguel Gavilan Molina, who is deeply engaged in the current retaking and liberating of Alcatraz. And people who listen, well, I can't say that because, well, Gavilan, jump in.
Always good to hear your voice, Bill. And just on the point that, you know, Bill was making, I think that, you know, there's a resurgence happening right now. But I think that what happened back in 69, when those students, and along with Richard Oakes and them, made that leap, you know, from the boats into the water, into the rock, it stopped momentarily the whole idea. When they made it to the rock, it was like coming out of the unknown past, or, you know, we didn't exist anymore. Indigenous people had disappeared. You only saw them in Western movies and so forth. But that day, that leap, and those students and those individuals that did that, they took the past to the present and said, we are here. This is occupied land. You know, it's under occupation. And it awakened the consciousness of indigenous people who had been beaten and battered into submission or domination. Finally, it awakened. And that's only been growing. And it's something that I witnessed. I've been fortunate to have been there, being part of that effort, and bringing KPFA, bringing Radio Free Alcatraz, you know, back to the rock, and doing the traditional gatherings. It's something that brings all nations from all four directions, all four colors. It's amazing the way it's evolved. But I think in it and of it all, there's a certain situation that is occurring, and that is that there's a threat to our cultures, and particularly yes, where there's been this spiritual cultural war, you know, sweeping across the country. And it seems like now the evangelicals and the Confederacy have taken over the U.S. Capitol. They're looking at Indian lands. They're looking at public lands. They already have plans. And my whole thing is, how is that going to affect, you know, what we do and even our gatherings? Bill, I know that, you know, as a veteran, not only engaging, you know, in war conflict, but surviving it and then coming back and being one of the strongest vocal voices against U.S. colonialism and its domination of indigenous people. What do you see we can do, you know, in our gathering as we gather for to give thanks? You know, we're giving thanks for the harvest. And it's something that happened back, you know, in the days of the Pilgrims when they first came to Plymouth Rock and the local Indian tribe. I think it was the Pequots, I'm not sure. But that particular tribe, you know, saved them from starvation and being shipwrecked and everything, only to the following year, out of fear, paranoia, and whatever, they turned on the tribe and massacred over 700 members of that tribe. And that's what today, you know, is celebrated by the descendants of the Pilgrims and the Puritans. But our gathering there isn't about that. We do gather to celebrate our survival, you know, and we do gather afterwards and share foods for days, celebrating the harvest that Mother Sagrada, the Earth Mother, has given us. But Bill, in all of that, how do we confront the spiritual cultural war?
Well, I think that, you know, as one of my old friends in the movement by the name of Kwame Ture, he used to say, organize, organize, organize. And one of the things that happens when we have, like, the present leadership of the Republicans coming into the White House, it's going to take a lot of organization. But we have set the concrete already, because these movements have organized for years, and we only have to make a call. We only have to reestablish our visibility, to reestablish that, yes, we still care, that, yes, we still believe the land belongs to us. We still have a movement called Land Back. We're trying to reclaim some of the federal lands that belong to us by treaty rights. And remember, treaties are supreme law of the land. It says in the Article 6 of the United States Constitution, treaty law is the supreme law of the land. So we have the law behind us. But yet, because of this domination theory called the this domination theory that has ravaged our people, you know, everything from boarding schools, they try to take our culture, they took our land, and they took our rights and language, everything. And, of course, we have to remember that the church played a significant role in all this. So they're one of the greatest enemies of indigenous people as well, for stealing our souls, for baptismal, and changing our way of life, our way of relating to Mother Earth and to our Creator. So these are just a few of the things that they've been involved in putting us on reservations, which are the same thing as Bantustans in South Africa when they had apartheid. So apartheid didn't start in South Africa, it started here in America with the reservation system. So we have a long trail of oppression to overcome, but we're used to it. Survival has been the everyday mode of coming together for indigenous people. That's the way we survive, is we get together, we organize, and we have to do what we got to do. And once we're organized and we stand a chance against those forces, that we stand together, we can no longer, because of the media, because of KPFA and other outlets of media around the world, it's no longer easy to hide oppression like it used to be. We bring it out in the open. We look at it. We analyze it. We talk about it. We organize about it. So these are the positive aspects of oppression, that it organizes people that it brings people together to fight these apartheid systems. And we have to have our land because we are one with the land as indigenous people. And people have to understand that we live for Mother Earth. The earth is our mother. It's not just a commodity. It's not filled with minerals just so we can use the various extractive industries to exploit everything under, over, and around the earth. Our role is to preserve Mother Earth, not to exploit Mother Earth. So these are the things that we fight, no matter who's in the White House, no matter who's in the governmental positions throughout the Americas, because believe me, it's the Americas have been ravaged by, especially the United States and this part of the world.
Coconut.
Just a lot to take in because it's coming. And one of the things that I know, Bill, and that's that, you know, the spiritual aspect, especially when we see that, you know, the supremacists now that are taking over the White House, they've declared, you know, that this is their homeland. You know, it's like, did anybody teach them any kind of history? I mean, you know, really? Uh-huh. But they're pushing that. That's what they're pushing, that this land was created, uh-huh. you know, for the Puritans and, you know, the pilgrims came, you know, bringing their extreme Christianity beliefs. They're all extreme, even for, you know, your regular Christian or Catholic person. But it, with that idea, how do we counter that? That sentimentality that's coming and seeing us, not only tribal nations and indigenous peoples, but obstacles to be removed. How do we counter that?
I think we have to, you know, the way we counter it is we have to teach the young people our culture, which automatically puts us at odds with the government because we have our own language, we have our own system of government, we have our own way of surviving. You know, we've been through the boarding schools, we've been through the various apartheid policies, but they've been unsuccessful because when we organize in our culture, when we organize using the way of life that we established here long before they got here, then it's natural survival. I mean, it gives our people something to believe in. And when we believe in our who we are, then it's no problem to stand up to these white racists. There's no problem. I mean, it's an honor to stand up to those people. And so even though it's few, not all people are racist, so we depend also on our allies of the four colors to come together to also support the things that we believe in, because it is a survival mechanism for Mother Earth, for all people. That's included in the four directions. So it's not just survival of the Indian, it's the survival of everyone. So it behooves the non-Indian, the four colors of mankind, to come together to support the continuation of Mother Earth. And in order to support the continuation, the survival of Mother Earth, we have to make a stand as humanity. We have to make a stand because even Mother Earth is getting tired now. She's beginning to get mad. And so we have the extremes in the weather. We have the extremes in all the life of nature. And so we have to, and it really brings us together to be oppressed because we want to survive. And as well, other people, other colors are beginning to understand that a saying that we always have is called Metakoye Oyase. That means we're all related here on Mother Earth. And so as soon as we're teaching this to the non-indigenous people, they will begin to come forward and stand with us. And so we see a bright future in a way that other people can't see it, but we can see it.
Bill, part of the awareness and the prayer this year has everything to do with the genocide in Palestine. Could you quickly remind us the important relationship the indigenous communities of North America and the genocide? Now, the genocidist is wanted by the International Court for genocide. That connection, please.
Yeah, you know that when we first went to the United Nations to get recognition of our treaty rights and to try to establish international diplomacy with various governments, the people who stepped forward first were the Palestinian people, led by a man named Ambassador Terzi. And he's no longer with us anymore, but we established a relationship with the Palestinian people long ago. And I've been to not only Palestine, but Beirut, Iraq, and other places in the Middle East where the Arab people have a home. Just like us, they've been moving, they've been relocated, they've been their land taken over, and then, of course, now they're undergoing a tremendous genocide where children are starving. And, of course, they've been recognized as genocidal people because they're now declare Netanyahu, their president, as a war criminal. And he's wanted by the International Court of Justice, him and his top military leader. And so this is historic. This is probably the first time since Israel was established that their leaders have been declared international criminals. And rightfully so, because we all seen it in 3D. We seen it in Technicolor, the bombing, the genocide, you know, the children suffering. There's nothing more dramatic, nothing more treacherous than harming children. It affects you to your bone, to your inner heart, and you start crying inside, if not outside, right away because of the strong emotions that brings out to see the children suffer. So that's what we made this connection long ago with the Palestinian. Yasser Arafat told us, the Indians are we, the Palestinians are we, and the Palestinians are the Indian, and the Indian is the Palestinian. So that's a connection that we've had with the leadership of the PLO, and we work very closely with them at the United Nations. So they understand genocide. They understand the colonial intentions of foreign governments coming to their land. And so we found some immediate relatives when we met the Palestinians, and we've been working with them ever since, and we'll do everything in our power. We'd like to welcome to our communities. They get a chance to come over to Indian country, they'd be welcome. So we give that that homage, we give that brotherhood, that sisterhood to the Palestinian people.
Amazing. That's the voice of Mr. William Means, co-founder of the American Indian Movement, AIM, the International Indian Treaty Council. Miguel Gavala Molina has also been joining us for this very powerful interview with you, Bill. And Gavala, do you have a final comment question for Bill?
Well, just as Bill said, we have to prepare and come together, not just within our immediate barrios or reservations, but, just reach out, to others, from the four directions, the four colors. I've always said, we need to reach out to, the tree huggers, the dirt worshipers, the water protectors, those of that 60s flower power, hippie generation that are still around doing things. And their, grandchildren that are now adults, all peoples. This is, this is the time that we all need to come together to protect the Mother Earth, and also to prepare to survive what's coming. That said, Bill, felicidades to you and your familia, to Dolly and the kids, and we will be hearing your voice throughout, and stay warm and stay dry. And gracias again for joining us today. Tomorrow, we're going to be broadcasting from The Rock from 5 a.m. to 8 o'clock in the morning. And the crew, Radio Free Alcatraz crew, will come together from the Flash Onda crews. And as always, we've been there now, I believe, will be 34 years that we've carried on the tradition, the John Trudell and the original folks with Richard Bank and the students that took The Rock. That tradition of radio comes alive tomorrow, 5 o'clock in the morning. If you can't make it to The Rock, just tune in to 94.1 KPFA, and we'll be coming at you live to the annual gathering to give thanks to our survival and to give prayer to the end of the war and the genocide, and to pray for Mother Earth and her recovery. That said, tune in tomorrow morning. We'll be there. And as always, Dennis, presente.
Yes. Final words, Bill. We always are grateful for your presence, for your vision. Now more than ever, the work you've been doing all these years is incredibly important. Your final words for us.
I would like to say to our relatives to the South, throughout the Americas, La tierra es tu madre. Somos millones. Muchas gracias.
Éxito. Si se puede.
Si se puede. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstick, Bernstein, that is, with Miguel Gabriel Molina. And always presente, Mr. William Means. We thank both of you. And there's a lot more to come. You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to go to the West Bank, and we're going to hear what life is like under occupation and extreme violence in the name of, I don't know what. Stay with us. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. If all goes well, we are really proud and happy to welcome back to these airwaves Kate Raphael. She's a novelist, a journalist, an activist. She's been, for many years, engaged in trying to support the movement of liberation for the Palestinian people. And she puts her body where her beliefs are, along with her mind, which is brilliant. And we are happy to have you back. Kate, how are you doing? Where could you remind people, tell us where you are now, and just why you've gone to the West Bank?
So I'm in the village of Kusra in the Nablus region, so it's in the northeastern part of the West Bank, and I'm here, we're specifically in this village because it's one that has had a really massive escalation of settler violence and army violence since October 7th. Last year, just after October 7th, settlers invaded and killed two young men, and then at the funeral for them was attacked, and two other men were killed trying to bring the bodies back for the funeral, those men by the army, the Israeli army. And so there was a request for international presence, hoping that it would lessen the violence. And we believe that it has a little bit, and at least, and, you know, it does seem that the army tends to come in when they notice or think that all the internationals are not in the village. And so that is a signal to us that our presence does make a slight difference. There's still unrelenting army presence and settler incursions into the village, and an effort certainly to create the conditions where there will be extreme violence here. And also the army is like constantly threatening internationals and trying to find reasons to arrest us and get us out. So, I mean, the reason that I personally came, I haven't been in Palestine now for 20 years after I was deported in 2005 by Israel for my activism. And I decided to come back really because, from what I heard, the situation had changed so much that I felt like it was hard for me to give accurate information to others who were wanting to come and be protective presence here. And I felt like I needed to see for myself how the situation had changed in 20 years. And I mean, I certainly had heard that it had worsened, and I knew intellectually what that meant, or what that probably looked like, but I didn't really get what it feels like on the ground. And I mean, what it feels like here, it's really interesting to me to be thinking about this, talking about this on the eve of Thanksgiving, because I feel like if we really want to know what it might have been like, what life might have been like for Native Americans in the 18th and early 19th centuries in the U.S., we really can look to Israel and Palestine. And it's like here you can see how settler colonialism happens, how genocide and ethnic cleansing happens, how it works to take a land and just claim that the people who live here don't exist or don't have any right to be on the land, or that it's not really their land. And I see and hear that every day. And I mean, what has really hit me is how just unrelenting the violence and threat of violence is, the restrictions on movement, the restrictions on building, that, you know, people are almost never given permits to expand their homes. So, I mean, typically over the generations, people here leave sort of exposed rebar at the top of their house so that they can build another story when a kid gets married and wants to move their family into the family's ancestral home. And people can almost never, ever get permits to do that. And if they build without a permit, then their house is likely to be demolished by the Israeli army. And so it's just like that constant presence in your life. And like the army is in and out of the village every day, almost every day. We hear that there's army at one end or the other, or we see them because we're on the edge of the village. They come walking by our house, and we go out to see what they're doing, and the young men come out and sometimes throw stones at them, which is, you know, really traditional and iconic means of resistance when Israeli settlers and soldiers come into Palestinian villages, and the soldiers accuse the young people of escalating the situation. But they're the ones who are escalating it constantly by their presence, and they come in specifically for that purpose. And it's like the people in the village can never, ever relax, whether it's a wedding or it's a holiday or it's Friday, which is their day of rest, and they're excited to welcome family. They just never, ever know what's going to happen, when the violence might come, when things might go from a clash with tear gas to live bullets being shot and someone being killed. And that takes such a toll on people that I really see how demoralizing it is, and that people have just lost a lot of the hope and the strength to keep fighting that they had when I was here 20 years ago.
We're speaking with Kate Raphael. I believe you're from Seattle now. Do I have that right?
I live in Seattle, but I'm still a Bay Area person at heart.
And we're happy to have you, and we're happy that you thought of us in terms of sharing information and your trip to the occupied West Bank. You sent me some interesting sound, but I couldn't play it here. We had some problems, but I want to ask you to talk maybe now a little bit more specific about some of the particular encounters that you've had. I know you've had interesting interchanges. Can you share some of that with us? Who have you met on the trip from settler soldier world?
Yeah, so a couple of days ago, we were having breakfast, just sitting around talking about what we were going to do that day. It was raining, so the shepherd that we usually accompany did not take the sheep out, and suddenly somebody saw soldiers walking into the village from the nearby settlement. So we went out to see what they were doing. They claimed they were there because there was a car that was parked near our house that they said was stolen, had been stolen from, that it was an Israeli car that someone had stolen and changed the plates on, and they were investigating that. Why a stolen car in a Palestinian village is any business of the Israeli army is a little bit questionable, but they said, well, you know, a stolen car can be used for terrorism, so that then means we have to investigate every car in the village. And so we were following them, and there were some young men nearby who were not throwing stones, but were watching them. And the soldiers were walking further, like deeper into the village, and they kept saying that the young men were trying to escalate the situation. And I said, well, you know, to them, you're escalating the situation by coming into their village. And one of them disputed that this was in fact the village of the people who live here, and said, well, you know, if you want to talk about history, and he's like, well, forget the history, let's talk about the present. And he said, 40 years ago, or in the 40s, the Jews had a catastrophe and we lost 6 million people. And what did we do? We got over it. Which, I mean, is obviously not true. I mean, as a Jew who grew up, you know, years after the Holocaust, I mean, I was born 13 years after the end of World War II. You know, I can definitely say that we have not gotten over it, and we shouldn't get over it. But he was saying, well, the Palestinians just need to get over it, and they need to move on, and saying some really incredibly racist things about Palestinians, but also just denying their almost their whole right to exist and to live on their land. And I said, well, you know, he's like, well, they need to just get over it. And I said, well, nobody gets over the theft of their land. And he was like, oh, well, you know, how is it really their land? And it was just simply denying that the people who live here and who have lived here for generations have the right to be here. And, I mean, I know that this is a really common mindset among especially settlers, people who live in illegal settlements in the West Bank, but I have to say, I think it's a pretty common mindset, unfortunately, in Israel in general, but I don't usually hear it articulated so clearly. And the fact that these are the people walking into the village where I'm living is really terrifying for me, because if people really don't see the people that they're facing as human and as people with a history that they have a right to hold on to, then it makes it clear that they're going to be no holds barred in trying to eliminate those people, because they were walking into the village just denying that they were in the place that belongs to the people who live there. And I'll just tell one other story, which is yesterday we went, a group of us, about 10 of us, went with an older woman to land that she owns, which is right inside the gates of a settlement called Ephrat in the Bethlehem area. And she had a permit. She has had this land. This is her family's land. She's had it for many years, and her family before her. And so she wanted to pick her olives. I mean, olive picking season is really over, and it's very common that people with land inside settlements are the last to get permission to pick. She had permission. She had a permit to go that day to pick the olives. The soldiers at the gate told us no, we couldn't come in. They didn't even ask for her permit. She said, but I have permission. They didn't even ask for it. They didn't look at it. They just said, no, Mom, no, I'm forbidden. It's forbidden. And she was prepared to argue and kind of press, but the driver of the bus that we were on was afraid to, I think, to risk his bus, his license, and the violence. And he was like, no, we can't go. You'll have to come back another time with an Israeli car. And so, I mean, we had come all the way from Nablus to Bethlehem. It's about a 2-hour trip. You know, she had arranged this days in advance. She had the permit, and she couldn't gather her olives. And there was really nothing that we could do in that situation. And, you know, it's so arbitrary because she has been able to pick before. And so she had no reason to think that she wouldn't be able to this time. And, you know, it cost a lot of money to hire a bus and for the day. And, you know, she had carved out the time to pick with us, and, you know, you just can't do it. And there was nothing she could do. And, like, she can appeal it, but, you know, it's getting colder and colder, harder to do something.
And we're just talking about her picking her olives, right? She needs to get a document to pick her own olives, and she's risking her life to do it. That's life on the West Bank, right?
Exactly. And she did everything she was supposed to do, and after a certain age, people are supposedly not considered a threat, and she was well over that age. And then at the end, someone told her on the phone, she talked to someone on the phone, and they said, well, you can try it another time by yourself. But, I mean, this woman, she might be 80, she walks with a cane. I mean, she can't climb the ladders. She can't go by herself. She needs help.
Wow. You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're speaking with writer-activist Kate Raphael. She's in the occupied West Bank. I'm wondering if there's been much talk there about what's happening in Lebanon. Are people conscious of that, or is there some hope that you know, there might be some cessation in the violence in the West Bank, and of course the genocide in Palestine and Gaza. Are people paying attention to that?
People are very aware of the war in Lebanon. And, I mean, to be honest, the resistance of Hezbollah gives most people some hope, you know, because they think at least someone is standing up to the Israeli military and making it more difficult for them to fight, you know, to wage their battle, to basically claim the whole area of, you know, greater Palestine. But I haven't heard people, if you're referring to like the possibility that there might be a ceasefire in the war in Lebanon, I haven't heard anybody talking about that. I honestly don't hear people talking about ceasefires in general here. I think it's, this war has gone on so long, people don't feel even any hope that there will be a cessation in the violence. I think they're steeled for and resigned to just ever-increasing violence, and that eventually this really extreme violence will reach them.
What kind of communications are now taking place? I mean, even though Gaza is, you know, a stone's throw away from the West Bank, it's like it's on the other side of the world or a planet in another universe, because you can't get there. Is there, how do people communicate in the two communities? How is there an ongoing sort of dialogue? Is there, people must be horrified and always affected by the violence, however they find out about it, in terms of what's happening in Gaza and its connections to the West Bank and to the people in the West Bank.
I mean, everyone in the West Bank is very connected to Gaza. You know, many people have family there. Many people from Gaza now live in the West Bank. There are projects, in fact, to provide mutual aid to people who have managed to get from Gaza to the West Bank. There aren't that many, but there are some who are, you know, refugees once again in the West Bank, and especially young people have set up projects to help them find work and get clothing and make sure that they have shelter and food and what they need. And, you know, Gaza, there's a nightly vigil in Ramallah in the central square in solidarity with Gaza. People are definitely, you know, they're communicating with their relatives there the way people are doing in the States and everywhere else, through FaceTime, through Signal chats, maybe through WhatsApp. Actually, Signal is not very commonly used here, but WhatsApp for sure, and through telephones when people have the ability to use phones. I think a lot of the networks in Gaza are not working very well, so, you know, people are very reliant on, you know, finding a place where there's reception and internet, and if they have an eSIM or they have a way to charge their phone. And they, you know, usually people in Gaza have to go to a charging station. Like, most people don't have electricity at this point available in their house, so they have to go somewhere to charge their phone, and then they can talk to people for a few hours a day. And, you know, but people are also watching Al Jazeera and other news networks and, you know, getting the news and definitely talking about it. Our coordinator posts pretty regularly on our Signal chats, like news from Gaza information. Posted some just really devastating statistics the other day about how many entire families have been wiped out. And, you know, I think it's like 700 or something entire families that have been killed, murdered in Gaza. So, yeah, I mean, people are very, very conscious of the situation in Gaza and always getting as much information as they can. And, you know, at any demonstration, we went to a demonstration the other day in Nablus that was for in solidarity with women political prisoners for the International Day Against Gender Violence. But, you know, even though it was in solidarity with political prisoners, people were talking a lot about Gaza. And, of course, many of the prisoners are from Gaza, but more of them from the West Bank because people in Gaza are being just murdered. And, you know, but people were talking a great deal. A lot of the speeches, you know, everybody was referring to Gaza. And we're with you, Gaza. You know, it's the constant chant.
What's on your mind? We have a couple of minutes left. What would you like to share? Your thoughts? Do you think it's a good idea? Would you encourage other people to come and stay in the West Bank? Do you think it's crucial at this time? Give us, just share a few thoughts with us.
I mean, I do. I, you know, we were talking about this just yesterday. Like, do we think that our presence makes a difference? And, I mean, I think compared to when I was here 20 years ago, I'm not sure that we have the as much impact on what the army does or even what settlers feel empowered to do. But I do think it's really important, and it's important for the people here to see that there is international solidarity. Like, they may hear about it. You know, certainly I heard that when the encampments were happening on college campuses, that people in the villages were riveted to their phones, listening to the news from the movement in the States, and that that gave them so much hope and energy. But seeing people up close, having people in their own villages and in their own towns, you know, at the demonstration the other day, everybody wanted to take their pictures with us. I mean, everyone was asking us, where are you from? And, you know, when we would say America, most of them would say, oh, I love America. And then, you know, that's always challenging for us. But, I mean, I really do think that our being here just gives people a little bit more will, a little bit more strength to keep fighting for their rights and keep saying, yeah, this is our land and we're not moving, we're going to stay. And, you know, so, yeah, I would encourage people to check out FAZA is the movement that I'm with. It's FAZ3A. And you can look it up and go to the website, sign up to get more information. And someone will email you. And there's also the International Solidarity Movement here. And to get connected with them, palsolidarity.org. And you can email. There's an email on that site to start the process of looking into coming.
Thank you, Kay Raphael, for taking the time out to be with us, talking to us from the occupied West Bank. Incredibly important, the work that you're doing, and we really, really appreciate it. Stay safe if possible. Stay in touch. We are always ready to take your call. Be safe.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're incredibly welcome. We'll be back. We'll be right back.
We're all horrified by the events happening in Gaza and Israel. This is a moment when KPFA is needed most, because maybe...
Join KPFK for our end-of-year fun drive, which starts on Giving Tuesday, December 3rd at midnight with Something's Happening. Giving Tuesday is a global generosity movement.